All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Anna Amanda L. Meredith presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. To my right is Judge Falvey, and to my left is Judge Lauer. We are here today in the matter of Lechleiter versus McDonough, docket number 232587. Will counsel, beginning with petitioner's counsel, please note your appearance for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tom Stover for the petitioner, Colonel Jerry Lechleiter.
Good morning. Deborah Bernal for the Secretary, joined by Edward Cassidy, Deputy.
Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Counsel for the petitioner, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. We'll make that happen. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge Meredith. May it please the court. Again, my name is Tom Stover, and I represent the petitioner this morning, Colonel Gerald Lechleiter. At the outset, I'd like to just review a few facts. They're set out in our briefing, but very quickly. I think it's important to remember that Colonel Lechleiter served his country well and faithfully for over 30 years, retired as a colonel from the United States Army. He is a very sophisticated user of the Veterans Benefits System. He's made several claims himself, as well as helping other veterans to perfect their claims. He has asked the Secretary to provide him with remote, read-only access to the Veterans Benefits Management System, or VBMS. He was told by a veteran's rep at the VARO that he could not have that access, but he was never told why. He was instead sent a CD that contained over 10,000 pages of records from his file. Those records were not in chronological order. Many of them were broken up, so it would be page 1, 2, and 3 here, and then 5, 6, and 7, you know, further on in the CD. There was no index. There was no way to search the CD. Colonel Lechleiter, in his declaration submitted to the court, made it clear that his laptop didn't even have a CD player. He had to go out and buy one. Colonel Lechleiter persisted and asked the VA if there was any way he could access the system electronically, and he was told yes. He could come use a terminal at a VA regional office that was designated for veterans to access their records. He asked, well, I'm in Delaware. I'd like to go to my set aside some time to go to the VARO here in Wilmington and look at those records, and he was told, oh, well, we don't have a terminal here in Wilmington, so you'll have to go to Philadelphia. When he called the Philadelphia VARO, he was told, well, our terminal isn't operational, but you can come down and use the laptop of one of our VA officers here. The only condition is that the VA officer will need to sit with you and look over your shoulder as you're reviewing your records. And for obvious reasons, neither of those solutions was acceptable to Colonel Lechleiter. So he filed papers with this court asking the court to issue a writ of mandamus pursuant to the All Writs Act to the Secretary to provide him with a final written decision respecting his access, remote read-only access to the VBMS system. That has not yet happened. And so we are here today asking this court to issue that very writ, that the Secretary of the General Counsel's Office provide a written explanation of why it is that Colonel Lechleiter is not allowed to access the VBMS system on a remote read-only basis.
Counselor, could I? I could jump
in. Not all at once.
Just to clarify,
yes.
You asked for, right now, an appealable decision as to whether Mr. Lechleiter could have access to VBMS. In the initial pleadings before you entered the case, the petitioner had asked for additional relief, a show cause order under 1651B, or have the court invalidate VA's regulations on who can access VBMS remotely. Can you clarify for us, is the only relief the petitioner is seeking now is an appealable decision from the VA?
That's exactly right. And we think the Chisholm case provides a blueprint, and I'd like to go into that. But before I do, Judge Lauer, if you have a question you want me to answer at this point, I'm happy to do that.
Could I just clarify the clock, though? I believe it started at 30 instead of at 20.
It did. I'll keep my eye on it. Thank you.
Mr. Stover, before you leave the factual basis for the petition, can you please tell us what the status is of Colonel Lechleiter's accreditation with the VA in order to...
He is not accredited in any way with the VA.
Okay, and based on the pleadings, there was an affidavit in there that basically he had gone through the hoops with respect to the background and the reputation, but it was, as I recall, the actual examination that was not completed. Is that...
The examination for accreditation?
Yes.
To be perfectly honest, Judge, I don't recall now. I just know that he does not have any accreditation. He does help other veterans on a pro bono basis because he's familiar with the system, but he does not have any accreditation through any VSO or with the VA.
Okay, and so when he, again, there is mention of assisting a sergeant first class with a claim that worked its way through and eventually wound up at this court.
Yes.
But he was not accredited at the time.
Not accredited.
And is not currently accredited.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stover.
I just want to follow up, though. He's not seeking accreditation as part of his petition because
he is not.
Read his original pleadings before you became involved. There seems to be some indication that accreditation was a remedy that he was seeking as well, but no.
To be clear and to go back to Judge Meredith's question, the only remedy we're seeking today is a writ of mandamus directed to the Secretary. Asking the Secretary or the VA General Counsel to issue a written decision, which can then be appealed to the Board of Veterans Appeals and, if necessary, ultimately to this court. So we're not seeking accreditation or anything, you know, beyond the scope of that.
All right. And when you say remote access to VBMS, it's for his file only.
That's all we're asking
for. Despite his help to other veterans or everything, it's to look at his... To have remote access to his VBMS.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Colonel Lechleiter has not asked, has never asked, for remote read-only access to someone else's VBMS file. It is only for his VBMS file.
You started out by describing some of the inconvenience that the veteran has faced here in accessing his files. Under the Rosinski cases, in order for the petitioner to have standing, he has to show that he suffered an injury in fact, an invasion of a legally protected interest, which is concrete and particularized, actual or imminent. Can you walk through us what is the legally protected interest that's been invaded here, and what is the concrete harm?
Well, I'll do it in reverse. The concrete harm is his ability to perfect his claim. One of the problems that Colonel Lechleiter has identified, and it's laid out in the papers that we filed in his declaration, is that there are some records in the VBMS file that he did not generate, although they purport to be generated by him. And so making sure that the record is correct is one of the harms that he would face as he pursues his claims for benefits. Going to the standing question, the first leg of the three-legged stool for standing is that concrete harm. And the concrete harm here, I think, is really twofold. One, as a veteran, he's entitled to certain benefits, and he is entitled to perfect to all of the aid and assistance that the VA can provide in order to perfect those benefit claims. By refusing him this form of access, the VA, and making it virtually impossible for him to access the VBMS file through a terminal that's set up at a VARO office because they're apparently not available, the VA has harmed Colonel Lechleiter by preventing him, creating a barrier to his ability to perfect his claim. There's a second way he's harmed. And the second way he's harmed goes to equal protection. And this goes beyond Colonel Lechleiter. For any veteran who is not represented by counsel, maybe because they choose not to be represented by counsel like Colonel Lechleiter, maybe because they cannot afford counsel, maybe because they do not have access to counsel, for any veteran who does not have access to counsel, they are prevented from that remote read-only access. They may live in, you know, way out in the corner of North Dakota. They may live in downtown Denver, where I live. But they may, for lots of reasons, choose or not be able to have an attorney, and they are prevented from having this kind of access, prevented from having a tool that allows them to review the record in an organized, chronological
format. But you're not trying to expand the scope of this to a class action or something, are you?
Not yet.
Well,
I'm not going to say.
The case before us, not the one that might come.
Exactly right. But the question was about standing, and I think that the standing does go to equal protection, and there may be an equal protection argument once the secretary issues that written decision. We may have an equal protection argument, and I think that is.
If for example, they say remote VBM access is limited to accredited agents and attorneys.
Exactly right. I'll give you another example.
You think it should be opened up to all veterans?
I think it should be opened up to anybody who applies for it. And we're not necessarily. I mean, the case before us.
But they have to be limited to their own individual file.
And that's all that we're asking for. That's all that Colonel Lechleiter has asked for. That's the only thing that we would ask the VA General Counsel to opine on. I want to give one other example on the stand. Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Stover. No. When you say applies, what does that mean? Just a simple request for access, or does it mean something more?
Well, I think we'd have to see what the secretary says. I mean, some of this is dependent upon what the VA General Counsel decides to do. We do not disagree that there is a need for security. We do not disagree that there is a need for privacy. But all of us know in our daily lives that we access our health records, our banking records, our employment records. All of this stuff is online. All of this stuff is accessible to us. And all of this stuff has an incredible premium on privacy and an incredible premium for security. And yet we're able to do it. The VA allows veterans to access their medical records online, remote read-only access to their medical records. Again, very private, needs to be very secure. So clearly the VA has the ability to do that. If a veteran says, I want remote read-only access to my records and has to fill out a form in order to do that, that's fine, but I think that's a process that I would defer to the General Counsel on. If I'm asked, I may have some comments, because obviously we want to make it as easy as possible for veterans to have this kind of access. But I think that certainly some kind of application would not be inappropriate in this context.
But you would distinguish that from the steps laid out in the federal reg under 1.160 through 603?
I would. And the reason I would is because inherent in those steps, and if you look back at the Federal Register, you'll see it's very clearly laid out, a lot of those steps relate to the control that this court and the VA have over accredited representatives, whether they're an attorney and therefore subject to the rules of professional conduct, or they're an agent of a VSO, and subject to the accreditation. So, yes, I would say it needs to be different. It cannot be the same as the standards set out in those regs. I want to go back to my final example on standing, and that is, since I took this case on, I've gotten a number of interesting emails from VSO agents around the country, and they've all told me, you know, I'm a VSO agent at thus and such agency or thus and such organization, and I have access to my own VA records through the VBMS. By virtue of my status as a representative of an accredited organization. And Judge Lauer, this goes back to a question you asked. To be clear, it is the organization that is accredited. It is not the individual within the organization. And you probably saw the humorous footnote in the Chisholm case where the judge said that it could extend all the way down to the bartender at the VFW post. I mean, that is taken to an extreme, but it's literally true that the organization is accredited, not the individuals working for the organization. So to go back to the equal protection point, there are veterans who do have this remote read-only access by virtue of their employment with a veteran services organization. There are other veterans, like Colonel Lechleiter, who is not employed by a veteran services organization, who does not have that access. Now, I think that that satisfies the concrete harm element of the standing three-legged stool.
Jump in there. You had mentioned that part of the harm may be that the veteran needs additional information in order to perfect his appeal as to the prostate cancer claim that's pending. What additional information is it that he needs, that VBMS provides, that the CD does not? I know he mentioned that there are notes in the VBMS talking about which office inputted certain information and at what time. How does that explain for us how that information helps perfect an appeal as to the prostate cancer claim?
Well, I would answer that question in two ways. First is, what it does is it allows the veteran to determine the accuracy of the record. And as I've already described to you, Colonel Lechleiter found material in his on that CD, it was part of his record, that he did not generate and was purportedly generated for his benefit by someone at the VA. And it was inaccurate, it was incorrect. And when he asked, you know, who did this and why is it in my record, no one could say.
Information was contained on the disk, though.
Yes, it was. But it was contained within 10,000 pages of unsearchable documents that with no index and out of chronological order.
What you described, though, I mean, that's the record before the agency. That's what we work with. It's searchable at some level. VBMS, I'm told, is a challenge to search itself. We don't get indexes of the record that's provided to us. What is it that you're... Why is that adequate for the court? Why is that adequate for the record, but it's not adequate for everyone else?
Well, I think a couple of things. First off, a veteran is not a lawyer, generally, not a lawyer. Not a judge, doesn't have staff, is trying to prepare a claim on his or her own. And that's the vast majority of veterans that we're talking about. In the case of someone who served for a long time, those records are voluminous. VBMS is in chronological order. It is searchable. It does allow someone to log in from, you know, their home on their computer, to take notes and to work in an environment that's most conducive to them. And let's not forget that many veterans have difficulty, you know, going outside and interacting with people at a VSO or at a VARO. And so I think that there are reasons why we want to make this information as available as we possibly can to every veteran who may want to utilize it.
Okay, well, those are sound, you know, policy considerations, I guess, but the legal requirement that requires this.
Well, I mean, I think that put simply, there is no law that requires this. There is, however, a body of law that makes it very clear, and this is from the Henderson case, that makes it very clear that it is the VA's duty to take every step possible to help a veteran perfect his claim. And when the VA or any court is looking at the laws that relate to a veteran's benefits, that they are to read those laws in a way that always bends in favor of the veteran. And if VBMS, if remote read-only access to VBMS is available to attorneys, to their legal assistants, to their legal staff, to law students, to employees of VSOs who have not themselves gotten a special accreditation to access it. If it's accessible to veterans who go to a terminal in a VARO or who look over the shoulder of a lawyer or a law student who is accessing that, why can't it also be accessible to a veteran who wants to sit at his dining room table and look at his records and prepare his claim? And I think that the body of law, the body of case law certainly suggests that if the VA is doing everything it can to help veterans perfect their claims, that this is one step that the VA can take without compromising security, without compromising privacy, and do it fairly easily.
Just follow up there.
Yeah.
To Judge Falvey's question about the legal basis for this. As a mm-hmm. policy matter, that's mm-hmm. another question. But if this boils down to inconvenience, the inconvenience of having to either look at the CD or go to the regional office to look at the UMS, what is the legal basis for that? That is a sufficient harm to satisfy the standing requirement.
Right. Well, let me back up a step. First off, we're not asking today for that access. Okay. What we're asking for today is we're asking the court to direct the general counsel to provide a response to Colonel Lechleiter's request. So we'll see what the general counsel says, and we may be back here having this conversation a second time. I think that but your question goes to what is the harm. There was no access at the VARO. There was no access in Wilmington or in Philadelphia. I don't know if there is a terminal at any VRO anywhere in the country that provides this kind of access. Colonel Lechleiter couldn't get it, and that is the harm that Colonel Lechleiter experienced, because he could not access the VBMS system even in the places where the VA told him it was available.
Sure, I heard an answer, though, as to what's the legal basis for that, that the inconvenience of not having that access or having to use the CD, what's the legal basis for saying that that's a sufficient concrete harm?
I would go back to Henderson. Again, Henderson makes it very clear that the VA is supposed to do everything that it can to help a veteran perfect its claim, and that when courts are interpreting the statutes that allow provide for veterans benefits, that there's that everything is supposed to bend in the veteran's favor. And I think that that precedent is sufficient, again, for purposes of issuing a writ of mandamus in this case, as opposed to actually deciding the question. I do want to go back to...
We'll just keep the clock running.
Okay, thank you. I do want to go back to Chisholm for just a moment, because I think Chisholm provides a blueprint for this. The court will recall that in Chisholm, it was an attorney who was seeking access to the VBMS system for his legal assistant. And the court went through that analysis very clearly, and the court determined that it had the authority to issue a writ. It did, in fact, issue a writ to the secretary, directing the secretary to provide a written response to the attorney's request for his paralegal to have access. And I think that, after Chisholm, of course, Green came down, and then the Carpenter decision. Those two decisions, Green and Carpenter, turned on the fact that VBMS was not part of 38 CFR 1.600. Now, of course, with the 2022 amendments to those sections, VBMS is very clearly a part of that. So I think that Chisholm provides a blueprint. It clearly shows that the court has jurisdiction. It clearly shows that the petitioner has standing. And we think that if an attorney has standing to ask for access to his legal assistance, certainly a veteran must also have access.
Mr. Stover, would you acknowledge that there is some supervisory oversight, however, for those individuals? In other words,
I know Mr. Chisholm, and I know that that's absolutely true in his case. I will not say that that's true in every case. It should be, but it's not necessarily true. When you consider the universe of people who have access, the lawyer, him or herself, the lawyer's paralegals, the lawyer's staff, which may or may not be someone who's bound by the rules of professional conduct, depending on where the lawyer is practicing, interns, law students, it's a large group of people.
And what is the purpose for that supervisory requirement? And we can,
what is the purpose for it
here? But in terms of distinguishing, what is the purpose?
As I understand the purpose for it is these people are reviewing not just a single individual's records, but many individuals' records. So there's a much greater concern about privacy as between clients, as well as privacy to the larger world. What we're asking for here is Colonel Lechleiter's ability to review his records. So he's not going to be seeing someone else's records. His private material is going to be protected by him because he has an interest in protecting it, which is very different from a staff member in a law firm.
Okay, but within a record, oftentimes there's information regarding other service members, veterans. I don't know how familiar you are with going through records, but but have you seen examples where and you know what type of information have you seen that pertains to others that would be a potential interest in protecting?
Well, you've asked me a hypothetical question, so I'm going to answer it in two ways. First, if that information is in, I'll use myself as an example. If that information is in my record, and it is there for the board or someone else to make a determination about my eligibility for benefits, I think I should have access to it. Even if it names another service member who might have provided testimony, oh, I saw Mr. Stover and he wasn't anywhere near the front lines. Secondly, I think that it is possible, and the VA has done this, it's possible to redact some of that information. That's done routinely when CDs are provided. And so,
do you know, does VBMS allow redactions within
I don't know that. I don't know. If there's no further questions, I'm down to 5 minutes. So I'm going to reserve that time for rebuttal.
We started with 30, so.
I'm sorry?
You started with 30.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you.
Councilman Secretary, you have 5 additional minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case is not about access to VBMS. It's about the scope of this Court's jurisdiction and whether the Court has the authority to provide the relief petitioner seeks. Petitioner has not met his burden of demonstrating that the Court has subject matter jurisdiction over this dispute. Counsel argued that the only relief sought at this point is an appealable decision. However, the discussion showed that really the petition itself is a facial challenge to VA's regulations regarding access to VBMS, which do not include self-represented claimants. The proper forum for that type of dispute is at the Federal Circuit under 38 U.S.C. 502. The petition here should be dismissed. I welcome the Court's questions.
I do want to explore that with you, but I do want to ask a few questions about VBMS first. Is VBMS some is it capable of redactions?
No, Your Honor.
Is it chronological?
It's somewhat. It's the most recent documents are in the beginning, and the older documents tend to be at the end, but it depends on the way the veteran has submitted evidence. So if a veteran, for example, submits a statement in support of claim and attaches all their service medical records, all of those are going to be rescanned in. So the service medical records will appear at the end of VBMS because it kind of goes from oldest to young to newest. But then they'll appear again in the middle if the veteran resubmits them, or if the veteran submits a buddy statement 5, 6, 7 times. Every time it's submitted, it's scanned in. So that's why the documents have the possibility of being in there multiple times. And that's why the CD contains the documents multiple times, because the CD is a replication of the VBMS file.
Is it searchable?
I believe VBMS is searchable.
Are there VBMS systems to access at ROs or VA hospitals, or a veteran to just sit down at and look at themselves?
No, Your Honor. A veteran shouldn't be looking at VBMS at all by themselves. VBMS is an internal-facing, it's a live VA operating system that where the claims files that used to be in paper were sort of scanned in and converted over to this electronic system. So
it's not unsurprising that Mr. Lechleiter wouldn't have access to it in Pennsylvania or Delaware or New Jersey?
Well, Your Honor, if he'd like to review his VBMS file, from what I understand, both the Wilmington and the Philadelphia ROs have a standard operating procedure that allows him to make an appointment and view the file with supervision by a VA employee or on the VA employee's device.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, you said to review VBMS, I think what you meant is the claims file, the individual claimant's claims file using VBMS.
Yes, Your Honor, although I think we don't use the phrase, the terminology claims file after it's been scanned into VBMS. We just kind of refer to it as the VBMS file, and what used to be the original claims file we call the source documents.
Okay, so the source documents related only to that claimant, of course, recognizing that there may be other documents that involve other individuals.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and so it sort of begs the question, is there a route for an individual claimant to be accredited in order to gain access to that claimant's files related to their claim? And what is that route, if there is?
No, Your Honor, there is not. There is a route for the claimant to be accredited as a VSO, but under VA's regulations, the newly amended regulations, and the old version of the regulations, they would have access to their client's records. An individual's access to their own records is governed by the Privacy Act. The VA regulations 1.600 to 1.603 address an individual's access as an agent, attorney, VSO, or staff member to someone else's records for the purpose of representing them in their claim.
Okay, but Colonel Lechleiter's argument here is not that he can't receive information under the FOIA or the Privacy Act about himself. His argument is that he should receive the same access as others who, maybe the distinction you're drawing is, are representing, if we use the general term representative, right, that encompasses everything, attorneys, paralegals, other representatives. But that's the argument here. Is that the distinction you're making, is that if you're requesting it about your own files, that it automatically falls under the Privacy Act and FOIA, whereas if you're requesting access to documents related to someone else as a representative, that would have more to do with the accreditation process and then, of course, the designation that's required as well?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the distinction I'm making. And, again, that brings us back to 502, which, as noted, the VA regulations regarding accreditation and access were amended in July 2022 to include VBMS. And if the position, which it appears to be, is that those regulations are not reasonable because they don't include self-represented claimants, that's a direct challenge to the reasonableness of the regulations that needs to be raised directly in the Federal Circuit. And I will note that petitioner's claim for service connection for prostate cancer was denied in an October 2023 rating decision. He has a year to appeal that decision, and if he does, he'll receive a board decision, and he can appeal to this court arguing that the board decision was legally flawed because he wasn't given access to VBMS. That would put the issue before this court in an as-applied challenge, and the court would have the validity of the VA regulations before it. But that's not what we have here. Here we have essentially an attempted direct challenge to the newly enacted VA regulations, which cannot be entertained in this venue.
I could ask you about those regulations. Under 1.601A3 gives VA the authority to deny access, remote access to VBMS. And part of the reasons that you could deny it is someone doesn't meet A1 or A2. A1 lists those individuals who are eligible for remote VBMS access, basically the attorneys, agents, VSOs, their support staff. And then under 1.603, VA lays out the decision-making process for how you'd go about denying access to VBMS and issuing a decision on that. But it appears from the facts of this case, VA has never responded to the veteran's request for remote VBM access, and it appears it's because he's not one of those people listed in 1.601A1. He's not an agent or attorney. My question is, Are you essentially making a decision that he doesn't satisfy the criteria and just not telling him and issuing him a decision? You've made a decision that he's not among those in 1.601A1.
Not exactly, Your Honor. He didn't receive an appealable decision, but he received an email communication saying that access to his records is provided by the Privacy Act and that he could have a CD. And I will note in the...
Specifically said he could not have access to VBMS?
It did not say that, no. It said that his access is afforded by the Privacy Act, which guarantees access to his records, to an individual access to their own records. But I will note in the first of the Rosinsky cases, Mr. Rosinsky didn't receive an appealable decision. He received a similar email correspondence. And that's what happened here because Mr. Lechleiter doesn't fall under the categories of people in the VA accreditation regulations.
Which I guess is my question is, why wouldn't you issue a decision saying you don't satisfy 1.601A1 as opposed to either not responding specifically to his request about remote access or giving him more than just an email saying, here's your CD?
Well, Your Honor, whether a decision or a more direct email or more direct letter was issued in response to his request or not, it would not be an appealable decision. It couldn't be an appealable decision because it wouldn't result in a board decision that this court would have jurisdiction over because, again, an individual's access to their own records is governed by the Privacy Act, which is not a law that affects the provision of benefits.
So I'd like to follow up on that point because when you promulgated the regulations 1.600 to 603, I believe VA cited sections of the United States Code 5721 to 5728 originally as the basis for the statutory authority, which those pertain to information security. But in the final rules, and maybe you have it in front of you, in the 87 Federal Register version, there's an amendment to all of the authorities for Part 1 of the Code of Federal Regulations. And it includes a number of different sections, including 5701, and then at the end says sections 1.600 and 1.603 were also issued under those information security provisions, 5721 to 28. So what is the statutory basis for these new regulations? Is it strictly the information security statutes, or is it also somewhat under Privacy Act or 5701?
Well, Your Honor, as you noted in the proposed rule, it was 5721 to 28. And in the final, it said 5701, which as the court found in Rosinsky, is a statute that affects the provision of benefits. But regardless, the regulations don't include, regardless of what statute they're implemented under, they still don't include representatives or self-represented claimants who are or anybody really who's not seeking to represent somebody else. And again, that brings us back to the 502 challenge, which if that's not reasonable, if the position is that's not reasonable, or even if this court believes that's not reasonable, this is not the venue that can consider that type of challenge. That would have to be a direct challenge to the reasonableness of the regulations raised in the Federal Circuit.
As to your point that the decision under 1.603 would not be appealable to the board, who makes those decisions under 1.603 to deny or revoke remote VBMS access? And is there any type of, I believe there's a reconsideration process, but is there any type of appeal process?
Well, if accredited agent...
You will give a decision to...
Yes. I believe the General Counsel's Office makes that decision, but I'm not 100% sure of that. It could be that VBA, which is essentially the agency of original jurisdiction for these type of issues, makes the decision, and then I think it might be appealable to the General Counsel's Office. But ultimately, a decision that's properly issued under the newly revised regulations would be appealable to the board. And one point about the Chisholm case, which counsel had.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I believe a denial of a decision from an accredited representative under the newly promulgated regulations would eventually be appealable to the board if they were covered by the regulations.
Okay.
How? Where does it say that?
Maybe I'm wrong about that. Actually, I think it's appealable to the general counsel's office.
Okay.
And then that decision from the general counsel's decision, I'm not sure, Your Honor, to be honest, but these regulations don't cover, they cover attorneys, agents, VSOs, and accredited reps and their staff. So Mr. Lechleiter is not covered by
these. Mr. Lechleiter had gone through the process of seeking accreditation, which apparently he's abandoned. But if he'd continued that process and got a negative decision, he could then appeal that or seek reconsideration from the Office of General Counsel. There's no reason for him to, if he meets the requirements as laid out in 1601,
I believe
his failure to meet those requirements would be the reason for denial, not because he's not an attorney, not a VSO. Because an individual can get accredited, right?
Yes, Mr. Lechleiter could get accredited, but that wouldn't give him access to his own records. It would give him access under a power of attorney.
Well, couldn't he represent himself as an agent?
So VA's position on that, even for attorneys, is that if you are, that no, you're not supposed to be. You're,
how does it say that?
Well, in 1.601 A1, an applicant for access to VA IT systems for the purpose of providing representation or assisting in representing must be, and it goes through the criteria, but the regulations are written in a way where the representation is intended to be for somebody who's not yourself. And again, if that's unreasonable, that's an issue to bring to the Federal Circuit for consideration.
Where does this say that? I mean, obviously Colonel Lechleiter is representing himself up to this point until.
Well, 1.601 A1 little 2 big A requires the representative to hold power of attorney of one or more claimants and then goes through.
Can you give yourself the power of attorney?
Well, you wouldn't need a power of attorney for yourself. Not really, because you wouldn't need power of attorney because you are yourself.
He's the point we're getting to, isn't
he? I mean, for me, you could say, yep, I here's my power of attorney. I appoint myself to represent myself.
Well, again, that's not how VA views the way these access regulations operate, but that's not what we're faced with here, because Mr. Lechleiter did not pursue the accreditation. Okay.
But if he had, he would have gotten an appeal. He would have gotten a decision.
Yes.
Which he could have sought reconsideration, but he could not have taken the denial of the reconsideration to the board. Because that does, if nothing else, we could deny a writ because there's alternative administrative means of obtaining the relief. Continue the accreditation process, get a decision, and appeal it if it's an adverse decision to the board.
Well, Your Honor, that's what Robert Chisholm did when the court granted the Chisholm writ, in part telling VA to issue a decision. He appealed it to the board, and then it came up here and turned into Carpenter. And at that point, the court said VBMS was not part of the new regulations, the old regulations.
But it is now.
It is now. Right. So that's one adequate alternative means to obtain the relief sought.
But it's only an adequate alternative means if an adverse decision of 1.601 to 603 can be appealed to the board. Right? I mean, we don't have jurisdiction if it's – or we can't say that if it doesn't result in a potentially in a board decision.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. But another adequate alternative means is to directly challenge the regulations under 502.
I've got that. But I are adverse decisions from 1601 appealable to the board? That's my question.
Your Honor, I think that that's they used to be. I'm not sure if they are anymore. As Judge Meredith noted, the regulations were promulgated under different regulations than the old version of the regulations, which were under 5904. If it's 5701.
Why did they change that?
Well, I think after consideration, they thought that information security concerns were the primary basis for repromulgating the regulations under the new statute. And, you know, if it's 5701, the court has already said that that, too, is a regulation, as a statute that affects the provision of benefits. It's less clear if it's 5721 to 28. And I think I don't really think that particular issue is raised by this.
You're not saying that it was to avoid, to remove it from our jurisdiction. We'll just change where what the authorizing statute was so the court can't meddle in this.
Well, no, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. The court will decide for itself whether or not it has jurisdiction over VA's newly promulgated regulations, whether VA, promulgated them under a different section or not. I think in the Rosinski argument, VA's position there was that 5701 wasn't a law that affects the provision of benefits, and the court disagreed with that. And I think the attempted distinction was so that there wouldn't be subject matter jurisdiction. But here, that's not really the issue, because as an individual seeking access to his own records, he's governed by the Privacy Act, which I think is generally accepted as not a law that affects the provision of benefits.
His recourse would be in U.S. District Court.
Yes, which is another adequate alternative means, but only if his position is that he's been denied access. And he could appeal the denial of the service connection for claim for prostate disorder, which gets which would get the validity of the regulations before this court in an as-applied challenge. One note about that, it was the service connection claim was denied in October. It's an AMA claim, and the CD, a new CD, which contained all the contents in the VBMS, was provided on December 27, 2023. So at this point, Mr. Lechleiter has access to all the documents that the RO considered when it made the decision on his claim. And it's a closed record because it's an AMA case.
So that sounds like an acknowledgement, though, that Colonel Lechleiter is not requesting any documents. He's not alleging that there's something missing from the record here that's closed. He's pointed to nothing saying that there's something here, I don't have it, which would then presumably put you in a better position to use the Privacy Act to get something that's relevant to your case. In other words, I think the Secretary is acknowledging that that's not what is being requested here. It has nothing to do with something allegedly missing from his record. Is that an acknowledgement?
Well, Your Honor, the request for relief has evolved to some degree, but I think what he was alleging both in the original petition and now before the court is that he needs access to VBMS so that he can perfect his appeal to the board. And what I'm saying in response to that is he has everything that the RO considered when it made a decision on his claim on the most recent CD from December 2023. And so there's nothing additional in VBMS that would provide him greater access to help perfect the claim, the service connection claim for prostate cancer, because the record before the is closed as of the date of the RO decision.
Thank you.
Getting back to the statutory authority and whether these questions are appealable, under Section 5723, which is one of the provisions that VA originally cited in the proposed regulations, it lays out that the Assistant Secretary for Information Technology is responsible for establishing the standards for who will have access to VA systems. And then it talks about that the department information owners are the ones who determine who has access to the systems or systems containing sensitive personal information. So does that play into it all, whether a decision under 1.603 to deny or revoke access, is that a 511 question that's answered by the secretary? Is it answered by someone else in this chain, the assistant secretary or the department information owners? Does that bear on whether this is a 7104 question that could be appealed to the board?
Your Honor, it might, but I think that's a really good question for another day when the validity of the regulations are properly before the court, and the court can address whether or not these regulations implement, you know, 5701 or 5721 to 23, or even possibly 5904 like the old regulations did.
I'm not talking about the validity of the regulation. If you were to issue a decision, as you were discussing, under 1.603, denying remote access, is that a decision that could be appealed to the board? Does that bear on these provisions, delegating certain authorities on access to people other than the secretary and other than to the board? Does that come into play?
I think, Your Honor, that it's unclear whether under the new regulations a decision would be appealable to the board. And that's not what Mr. Lechleiter is asking for, but I think that that's a really interesting legal question, because the regulations were promulgated under pursuant to a different statute. So it's a bit unclear. If there are no further questions, the secretary would move the court to dismiss the petition.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the petitioner, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
I just want to note a couple of things. First, it's clear from this exchange that accreditation for Colonel Lechleiter is not a path for him to access his records. As I noted in my argument earlier, that's interesting. I have received emails from several people who are accredited who have access to their own records. So clearly there's some inconsistency there, but in any event, based on the representations here, the accreditation is not a path for Colonel Lechleiter to access his own records. I go back to the decision in Chisholm. As counsel for the secretary pointed out, Mr. Chisholm did, in fact, seek a writ in this court, sought a writ to obtain a final decision from the VA General Counsel for the purpose of appealing that decision to the board and then ultimately to this court. That is what Mr. Chisholm did, and that is, in fact, what Colonel Lechleiter proposes to do today.
But Mr. Chisholm could do that because accreditation was a path for him. You just acknowledge that it's not a path.
It was a path for him, but not for his staff. Recall that Chisholm was about allowing Mr. Chisholm, pardon me, the Chisholm decision was about allowing Mr. Chisholm's staff to have access. So yes, he could access it, but what he was asking for there is that his staff also have access.
Right, but Mr. Lechleiter, Are you acknowledging or conceding that accreditation is not an avenue for him?
I'm not conceding it. I'm just saying that that's what we've been told today by counsel for the secretary. That's not an issue. Honestly, Judge, that's not an issue that I've done enough looking at to be able to tell you. But certainly what you heard today is that is not – the VA does not consider that to be a path – right – for Colonel Lechleiter to review his own rules. And so I go back to the Chisholm decision. And – in Chisholm, as this court is very well aware, Mr. Chisholm did in fact get that decision, did appeal that to the Board of Appeals for Veterans Claims, and then brought it to this court for ultimate decision. Now, as the court is also aware, Mr. Chisholm ultimately decoupled his claim from Mr. Carpenter's claim, and the court decided them together, but Mr. Chisholm did not pursue that claim. I think that for all of the reasons that the court went forward with Chisholm in terms of the analysis of the All Writs Act, in terms of the analysis of the court's jurisdiction, in terms of the analysis of Mr. Chisholm's standing, in terms of issuing a writ to aid the prospective appellate jurisdiction of this court, all of those reasons apply equally to this case, and in fact, I would argue with greater force because Colonel Lechleiter is himself a veteran seeking to do this for his own, to perfect his own claim, as opposed to an attorney who is seeking to do this as part of his or her legal practice. Unless there are any questions, I don't have anything more to add at this point. Hearing none, Judge Meredith, one point of personal pride, if I might. This is the 30th year that I've been arguing before this court, and I know that we're going to be swearing in some new attorneys today, and I just want to say that it's been a pleasure to practice before the court. I hope I'll be back here again soon, and that this kind of work has been one of the highlights of my career, and I'm grateful to all of you and grateful to the court for the work that it does. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted for consideration, and before the judges come down to greet counsel, I'm going to swear in two new members of the court's bar. Mr. Christian Sanders and Ms. Sonia Williams. Mr. Sanders graduated from Columbia Law School in May 2023, and Ms. Williams graduated from the University of the District of Columbia, David A. Clark School of Law in May 2023. I see they've already come forward. I will come down to minister the oath.
Please raise your right hand for the administration of this court. Oh, administration of the oath of this court's bar. Do each of you solemnly swear to conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors at law according to the rules of this court, the rules of professional conduct, and the Constitution of the United States? I do. Now, both members of the court's bar, we have some framing certificates for each of you.
Here's the official photographer, too. So we have to do the other one again.
All rise.
Congratulations. Thank you. Mm-hmm.